This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Angie Baca.
And I am Amanda Johnson. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about a long-running poetry reading series featuring queer and trans poets, an artist who works focused on the stories of immigrants and the pressure that urban development puts on local wildlife habitats in West Philly.
But first, a program in Germantown aims to help community members get involved in the real estate development in their neighborhood. The program provides training for people who want to learn how to develop property and helps them access funding to get the job done. My co-host, Amanda Johnson, brings us this story.
Jumpstart Germantown is celebrating their 10-year anniversary this year. Jumpstart Germantown has many reasons to celebrate. Since the start of the program, the Jumpstart program model has multiplied and is now being used in over 20 communities in the United States. The Jumpstart program recently held their first mini conference. I had the chance to speak with the founder, Ken Weinstein. Ken is a real estate developer, and he says people were always asking him how could they get involved in real estate. He would meet with individuals one-on-one, but that became time-consuming, so he decided to teach a class. And that is how Jumpstart Germantown started.
Jumpstart is a unique economic development program that trains, mentors, networks, and loans money to aspiring real estate developers. We're teaching people how to improve their community, how to build wealth locally, and a lot of people over the last 10 years have successfully done that.
The 16-hour training program trains people from the community how to invest in or develop property in their neighborhood. Once the participants have graduated from the program, they're eligible to apply for a Jumpstart loan. Jumpstart Germantown has had 31 training program classes and over 1,600 graduates. Many of the graduates have completed projects that provide wealth for their families and reduce blight in their communities.
How do you feel about the first Jumpstart mini conference?
This is like a dream come true that folks from 25 communities around the country came together who are like-minded and want to help local residents improve their own neighborhoods, and we did it.
I had the opportunity to chat with a program participant from Gary, Indiana.
Hey, my name is Jasmine Rodriguez Buchanan. I am the real estate project manager and Jumpstart organizer for Jumpstart Indy in Indianapolis, Indiana. I work for the Martindale-Brightwood Community Development Corporation. We serve a small little neighborhood east of our downtown area that has been historically marginalized and is in need of some community revitalization and capacity building.
So what does Jumpstart mean to you?
Oh man, Jumpstart is everything. I am a Jumpstart graduate of the first year that they did it back in 2022 when I was just learning the industry. My husband had been in the industry and he had gotten sick. And so I was like, all right, well, this is our business. Let me actually start putting in work. And so when I found Jumpstart Indy, it really empowered me and provided me with so many tools and connections to just keep going. Here we are 4 years later. I now work for the CDC doing development on my own within the organization. And then I'm also the organizer. So it means everything to me on a personal level, on a professional level, on every single level.
During a segment of the mini conference, the participants were given an opportunity to share their why. Why did they become a part of the Jumpstart program? And why is the program important?
My answer is just one word, and that's access. To the financing, to the information, it really still is just the permission for people. The ability to understand that it's possible for them. It's been life-changing for people, and just even though you tell people it's possible, getting them to understand it and act upon it is still a barrier in our community, and so just communicating the understanding of access is my why.
We were in deficit. We didn't have any money,
And I learned from that program, you have assets. Why are you not selling them? Because I was always taught to keep them. I went home, I was so excited, we're going to sell that. And we're making $3 million off that project.
Nice.
I'm like, why didn't I know this? I'm a developer. But I was taught to keep the asset. So that's my why.
Before actually starting Jumpstart Wilmington, I started thinking about the community, particularly Black and Brown communities, and why so often people are able to acquire property who are not from there and develop it in a way that's not in the best interest of the community. And started reflecting more on the fact that if people within the community have more ownership of their community, there could be more sustainability.
This is a journey. It's not a destination, right? We can build all the houses in the world and we're still not gonna get there, you know? But it is about creating that sense of belonging for the people that we're touching, like myself. I did the program because my husband does construction. I never thought that I could be in real estate, like women. That was just not even a thought for me. And I feel so silly to even think that years ago. And so when this program came about, a lot of it is the organizational and the skills, but so much of it is just the belonging and really knowing that you have your stake in your community, in the world, because I truly believe when you know that you have the ownership, you have a stake, then you'll go out and feel empowered to learn the skills, you know? And so that's my why.
During the conference, speakers said that 48% of Jumpstart Philly borrowers identified as female, 83% as African-American, and 5% as Hispanic. There are currently several Jumpstart programs in Philadelphia. Of course, you have Jumpstart Germantown, but there is also Jumpstart Kensington, North Philly West, Norristown, Southwest, Tioga, and Germantown West Philly. If you would like more information about the Jumpstart program, or if you're interested in starting a program in your area, you can go to jumpstartphilly.com for more information.
For over a decade, a Philadelphia poet reading series called You Can't Kill a Poet has offered an outlet for queer and trans poets to share their work. Block by Block reporter and poet Camel Simmons brings us this story.
4 years ago, when I first moved to Philly, I was looking for a space to connect with other poets in the area and hopefully share some of my writing. I was looking for something accessible and fun. That's how I came across You Can't Kill a Poet. For the last 11 years, Boston Gordon has been running You Can't Kill a Poet, a free poetry reading for queer and trans poets most often hosted on the second floor of Tattooed Mom on South Street. You Can't Kill a Poet draws a large, rowdy, exuberant crowd that cheers for each of its readers. At times, the room overflows, attendees standing in the back when seats fill, and some squished together in bumper car seats behind the stage. I had the chance to attend and record the latest reading at Tattooed Mom on September 16th.
Everyone would know her name, her story, and that intersex people exist. A confession. When the saints go marching in, they will look like us.
That was Mariah Askew reading his poem, When the Saints Come Marching In. Inspired by poets he'd gone to school with and his experiences working in queer nightlife in Philadelphia, Boston started You Can't Kill a Poet following a desire for a more accessible poetry space that was easy to get involved with and reflected the rich queer and trans world he was experiencing.
Tell me a bit about that name, You Can't Kill a Poet. Where does it come from?
Back when I started the reading, I was looking for inspiration for what to name it, and it comes from a poem by Eileen Miles called Rotting Symbols, and I just thought the phrase You Can't Kill a Poet was like a very, very special phrase and very reflective of trying to form this like strong and exuberant, meaningful space for queer and trans poets.
You will, or maybe you already have created a story that I was too much, or maybe just not enough. That I was possessive and just one step out of step. And of course, You tried your very best.
That was Tyrell Brown reading their poem, Colder Than Closure. In 2023, You Can't Kill a Poet was named the best literary event in Philadelphia by Philadelphia Magazine for its longevity and curation of unique and talented poets.
I try hard to curate the readers list so that it is like a very good mix of folks who are like well-established, folks who are brand new. I mean, sometimes we have people who have never read poetry out loud before, people who just started writing poetry, people who are coming with their handwritten journals and reading what they wrote the day before. And then we've also had people who have like well-regarded books published, people who are academics, people who have been the poet laureates of Philadelphia, and then like everything in between. It's neither amateur open mic night, nor is it elitist and academic. It's like all those worlds combined.
Libraries, love, mental health issues, musical theater, name change, narrative podcasting, obtuse blogging, one shot, Philadelphia, pre-code films, punk bands, quiet intimacy, redemption arcs, remarriage, sad, sexual content, slice of life, sobriety, sympathetic adultery.
That was Alexa Vallejo reading her poem Fanfic for My 30s.
I try to set a tone that is more hooting and hollering and fun. Like, I want people to cheer for poems the way they would cheer for like a drag performance. The first couple ones, I was sort of like, come on, everybody, have energy. And like, I just like wasn't quite there yet. I would think about the people who I knew who hosted drag shows and sort of like try to use some of their humor, some of their anecdotes, some of their sort of like audience participation. And now I think the reading just like has, it just like has that energy. And if people come in the room and don't realize it has that energy, like we let them know very quickly.
I often forget about her father, a Playboy American pilot who left Manila before she was born, who gave her nothing but his last name and European blood. Gracious to a fault, my mother says he longed for family wherever he was stationed, that he loved children so much he sired them around the world.
That was a snippet from Alexa Vallejo's poem, Fish.
People read about the upsetting politics of our country. People read about their trauma. People read about their difficulties with their family or their relationships or their emotions or their mental health. But like people also read about like their joyful friendships and relationships and sex and fun and art. And I think it's very important to have a space where there is no one story about what it means to be queer or trans, and that all different people get to share whatever it is that they feel inspired to write about.
We'll see you in 2 months. You Can't Kill a Poet.
The next You Can't Kill a Poet is happening Tuesday, November 11th, 2025 at Tattooed Mom. You can learn more at You Can't Kill a Poet on Instagram. And I'd like to give a special thanks to Alexa Vallejo, Tyrell Brown, and Mariah Askew for their permission to use their work for this broadcast. They are all tagged on You Can't Kill a Poet's Instagram post recapping the September 16th reading.
Visual artist Tolu Bayar has been holding workshops with immigrants to the United States to share their stories in a handmade, one-of-a-kind book that celebrates their experiences. Tolu spoke with Block by Block reporter Nat Thomas at the Philly Photo Festival Book Fair last month and described the book and her plans for its future.
It's a unique book, so it doesn't have editions. It's all handmade, hand-bound, on handmade paper. And it's a collaborative project, and it's produced during the workshop, actually working with participants. They brought their selection of photographs, and they brought their immigration stories. And then I just got their permission to put it on a handbound book. And so I follow, of course, the recent events that affect humanity overall. especially the migrant crisis, because I'm a recent immigrant, and it took quite decades to get my citizenship. Therefore, I kind of have a lot of empathy for folks who are really trying hard to have their either green card or their citizenship here in this country. So I was volunteering for this nonprofit organization in my community, and then I decided to hold some workshops to create a safe space as well as some healing space for the recent immigrants and their families. That's how it started. I was interested in archiving their journeys, and the book came about afterwards. Sharing it with a larger humanity is really important, and I'm trying to put them in an installation format as well. As long as the participants are okay with it, I am very much interested in exposing these beautiful resilience stories to a larger community. The first book really took 2 years, and as this is an ongoing project, I'm really interested in finding more community partnerships and then creating these, you know, community workshops and then creating multiple consecutive, you know, following books. And also, sometimes we just think of the world in binary forms. It's either this or either that. Actually, like, life is more complicated than that, and life has lots of textures, and texture is beautiful. It's very aesthetic to me, so I use that texture. And also, texture is very manual to me, very handmade, and handmade always is about work of love, and it's about labor. It's about resilience. So all of these things really made me very, very naturally using texture in my artwork, comes very naturally in that regard. And so let me try to describe my most recent hand-bound book project. So this is an 8x6 book, hand-bound, made from handmade papers and filled with twine. The twine is a significant of like taking that route, that migration route. Twine and lots of photographic transfers of vernacular photography of the participants' photographs, and some text describing their journey, as well as some of their personal belongings that they wanted to share, and lots of also drawings or like miniature paintings that tie the image transfers together. And it's a very thick book because the handmade paper is a very thick paper, and the book is composed of 125 pages. So it's a pretty thick, as a sculptural object, you know, and it looks like something that you found in a library from 16th or 17th century. My projects are really about human beings, and it's human stories. Their stories need to be dignified and archived. I mean, we looked at immigration in numbers and political polarization, but maybe we can just shift the conversation about immigration for more about resilience and renewal. If I can contribute to that change, that transformation, then I would be very happy.
You can find out more about Tulu Bayar and her work at tulubayar.com. That's spelled T-U-L-U-B-A-Y-A-R.com.
Haddington Woods in West Philadelphia is right next to the historic Cobbs Creek Golf Course, which is currently in the middle of a $150 million redevelopment project that's scheduled to be completed in 2027. The redevelopment plan has been controversial in the community. Some longtime neighbors have pushed back against the plan to reshape the natural environment by uprooting hundreds of old and familiar trees. But with the redevelopment project already underway, Block by Block reporter Winter Schneider brings us this story about what it could mean for the future of the wildlife that calls Haddington Woods home.
I had heard about the golf course redevelopment a few years ago, but I've since relocated to this neighborhood, and I walk in Haddington Woods and on the overgrown greens of the golf course every day. The landscape is dominated by huge mounds of carved-up earth and giant piles of dead trees with their root bulbs exposed to the air. Between the grief over what has already passed and the anticipation of new life and activity in this place, on my walks, I found myself yearning to connect with a deeper story of the land, the woods, and all the life that depends on them.
We come over here and we see a crabapple tree. We come over here, we see a hackberry tree. We see a white oak tree.
As luck would have it, I met Anthony Bastian while on a walk in the woods one day. Anthony works with Haddington Woods as a Philly forest steward, and he also co-founded a small organization called Pennsylvania Habitat Connectivity. As a steward, Anthony supports the growth of young trees to combat rampant invasive species and improve the health of the woods overall. He shared his knowledge and perspective on how the woods is doing and how it could be improved.
The state of the woods is getting better. I mean, it's a very interesting area. You have this giant chunk of land that's next to Cobb Creek, this next to a golf course, which is next to Morris Park. It's about 60 acres of woods located off of 63rd Street, one of the largest woods in Philadelphia. It is also a place where the Parks Department is doing some experimentation with forestry. The difficulty is that it's separated by the golf course from other parks. It's separated by bridges and heavy traffic from the rest of the Cobb Creek Boulevard. It's not really connected to the wild habitats that surround it.
I asked Anthony to describe what that disconnected land means in terms of impact.
It basically creates islands of habitat, which are not good for animals. So specifically, if an area is fragmented by roads, railways, septa, golf courses, development, then basically animals live in these small patches of land, which makes it very difficult. For one thing, it's hard to find a mate. When they find a mate, it's hard for the young to disperse to find new territories. And then even their daily commute for foraging is very constricted. So it leads to inbreeding. It leads to smaller populations. If you want resilient wildlife populations of any kind, you need connected land.
While it's one thing to be concerned with how disconnected islands of habitat impact wildlife like beaver, foxes, porcupine, rodents, and many varieties of birds, I asked Anthony to describe how this disconnection or fragmentation also impacts us as human animals.
Basically, it comes down to safety for human beings and cars. There's billions of dollars worth of property damage done and hundreds of lives lost every year from people hitting deer or elk or large mammals. So if you would simply deconflict and get the animals off the road via various techniques, including fencing, warning signs, underpasses, you can save a lot of human lives as well. Secondly, human beings need open space just to sort of decompress. They need places to walk, bicycle. Usually these wildlife quarters have a human support component where there's a bicycle trail, walking path, as well as wildlife quarters. So it benefits all species.
Anthony became interested in wildlife connectivity through volunteering with a project in the Pacific Northwest called Yellowstone to Yukon that created a wildlife corridor with infrastructure like underpasses and overpasses to restore the migration corridors for animals on the land in the wake of human development. He brought that vision with him when he moved to the East Coast, where he linked up with a group called Wildlands Network.
The Wildlands Network has this concept. They want to produce an East Coast wildway from essentially the Everglades to Quebec. But the idea is to really have an Appalachian trail for animals. And they're going to have to put it together piece by piece, part by part, land easement by land easement.
I asked Anthony to describe what it would take to bring wildlife connectivity to the Haddington Woods.
I think it'd be a very good idea for the interested parties, the golf course, the local municipalities like Upper Darby, Haverford Township, City of Philadelphia, get together and see how they can cooperate, work with the golf course, work with the Departments of Transportation, try to knit this landscape back together. You need to change the way of thinking and sort of look at the landscape as a whole, not just a park, but the broader landscape. It is a functional corridor. A lot of it's polluted, a lot of it has trash, but nevertheless, the whole length of the watershed is a natural corridor with riparian buffers, which animals love, with a creek that flows year-round. And wouldn't it be great if we could extend it by adding Haddington Woods to it, adding the golf course to it, adding Morris Park to it, and so on. So that's a good example. It needs to be better protected.
But creating wildlife connectivity doesn't have to look like advocacy at the city or state level. Anthony says there are some steps that anyone in the community can take.
I think they can look for how to support connectivity among small habitat patches, even in the neighborhood. If you basically plant a pollinator garden in your yard, and a neighbor two blocks away did it, and a neighbor two blocks away did it, you would create, let's say, a miniature pollinator coordinator system. Or look for opportunities. If you see, let's say, a wild space, or even a cemetery or a park or an abandoned lot, see if there's barriers in between that and the next place that could allow the animals that live in your neighborhood to get a little bit more space to roam.
As we wrap up our conversation, Anthony points me towards the deeper story I had been looking for and the shift in approach necessary to creating life-giving conditions for all.
I think it's about reestablishing the connection between us and nature, which is somewhat broken in this country with the development of suburbia and dense urban environment with no parks. Other thing is to sort of recognize that the woods are sort of alive as an organism, not just the animals in them or the plants that are in them, to sort of see Haddington Woods as its own entity, as its own life. I mean, a river is its own thing. A river is alive. A river is alive. Haddington Woods is alive. See it as its own force of nature. It's never too late to create the linkages that help the wildlife. So it's sort of a wildlife justice issue. Another white oak has sort of rounded leaf like this. Instead of spiky, it's a white oak.
Block by Block is produced by Ivan Felder III, Kalisa Hamid, Helen Horseman Allen, Vanessa Lowe, Samantha Roll, Winter Schneider, Kennedy Scurry, Campbell Simmons, and us,
Amanda Johnson
and Angie Bacha. Kalisa Hamid is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is radio news managing editor for WPPM. Peter Liu is radio operations manager. And Allison Durham is the WPPM's radio program manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on Philly Cam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thank you for listening.